ally and supporter of then-President Boris Yeltsin, stepping in as president when Yeltsin had heart surgery in 1996. Most Russians remember Chernomyrdin for his tongue-in-cheek phrases during tough economic times, such as, better than vodka, there's nothing worse. Many of his idioms were adopted into popular lexicon. The former mechanic created the world's largest gas company, Gazprom, which holds about 17% of the planet's natural gas reserves. The state-controlled company is seen as Moscow's biggest bargaining chip on the world's economic market. For NPR News, I'm Jessica Gallagher in Moscow.
Niger has voted to end its military rule. With 90% of the vote, the country's new constitution passed. It reinstates presidential term limits. It also pardons members of the military who in February launched a coup. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Overbrook Foundation, supporting CatalogChoice.org, a nonprofit service that allows customers to decide which catalogs to receive in the mail.
On the next Fresh Air, we look at the election results and what they mean for Congress and the White House with Todd Purdom, national editor of Vanity Fair. He's written about John Boehner, Sarah Palin, Bill Clinton, Karl Rove, and President Obama. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support comes from the Prairie Ensemble, which opens its new season with A Taste at Tiernan's, an old opera house in downtown Urbana, on Tuesday, November 16th. Light snacks and a tasting of German wine and beer will accompany Beethoven's Septet in E-flat. Details are available at 355-9077 or prairieensemble.org.
This is Focus from Illinois Public Media on WILL Radio and online at illinois.edu, WILL.illinois.edu. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn. In this hour of Focus, we'll look at the decisions voters made on Election Day. With the help of Chicago political journalist and author Ted McClellan, Illinois Issues State House Bureau Chief Jamie Dunn, and former Illinois lawmaker Rick Winkle, now a senior fellow at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Listeners, we look forward to your questions and comments. Join us with a phone call or by email. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Rick Winkle is with me in the studio here in Urbana. He served in the Illinois General Assembly for 12 years, representing Champaign and Vermilion counties. The Republican served 8 years in the House and 4 in the Senate. He is the director of the Office of Public Leadership at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Jamie Dunn is on the phone with us this morning. She was named State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Issues in 2009. In addition to writing features for the magazine, she maintained its blog. And Ted McClelland, also with us on the telephone this morning. He's a former staff writer for the Chicago Reader. He's also written articles for many other publications. The author of 4 books. His most recent is Young Mr. Obama, Chicago and the Making of a Black President. Listeners, again, those phone numbers, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Rick Winkle, Jamie Dunn, Ted McClellan, thank you so much for joining us this morning. And I think the first thing we need to talk about is the race for the governor, the governor's race in Illinois. Bill Brady met with reporters this morning in Bloomington. He told them he believes he will win. He says he's going to wait for the official results after all of the absentee ballots are counted. Quinn, meanwhile, has predicted victory in a year that saw many other Democratic governors tossed out of office. Brady is trailing Quinn by the thinnest of margins, with 99% of precincts reporting Quinn's lead was just more than 8,300 votes of the 3.6 million cast. Quinn has nearly 47% of the vote compared to 46% for Brady. Let's begin with saying hello to Jamie Dunn and Ted McClelland there on the telephone.
Hi there.
Hi. And Rick Winkle here in the studio.
Glad to be here.
And Rick, I want to start with you this morning. What do you make of this governor's race?
Well, I frankly would not have predicted this. I did not predict this. I really thought the the race for U.S. Senate would be the one we'd be talking about today, that maybe would go into account and all that. But no, we're talking about the governor's race, which I thought Bill Brady would probably win by a few percentage points by gauging by polls. So much for polling. The poll that counted shows that they're separated by an extraordinarily small amount. And Bill Brady has announced, as you said, I mean, he wants to see the process, the certification of the vote count and all the ballots counted before he makes a declaration. So this could take several weeks.
Yeah. And to Ted McClelland and Jamie Dunn, maybe Jamie first, when Bill Brady won the primary defeating Kirk Dillard, what were your thoughts about Brady's chances to defeat Quinn?
Well, I think we knew it was going to be a bit of a hard row for him. It was such a slim margin, and this just kind of feels like history repeating itself as far as having a long wait on knowing who the winner would be. But there was so much anti-democratic sentiment nationwide that, you know, it seemed like he might have a good shot. And as it's panned out, a lot of governors, Democratic governors, have lost their seats nationwide.
Ted McClelland, your thoughts?
Well, I think Brady made a big mistake by demonizing Chicago in the election. I mean, just speaking as a Chicagoan, I mean, he was running. One time I talked to him, he said even Chicagoans don't like Chicago politicians, which is, you know, kind of a tough thing to sell because Chicagoans elect Chicago politicians. He just had a very downstate view of Illinois and thought that everybody would share his prejudices against Chicago, but this is where the votes are, and Chicago turned out for Quinn.
Sure, that looks like it's definitely going to hurt him in the end.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, you think that Quinn will be the governor?
Well, it looks like there's still about 14,000, maybe between 10,000 and 15,000 absentee ballots here in Cook County. And, I mean, those have been breaking 3-1 for Quinn. So that's just going to increase his lead. And there are only maybe about 2,000 military ballots. So I just don't see the numbers for Brady.
Rick Winkle, what do you think?
Well, I wouldn't disagree. I mean, I think it's going to be very difficult at this point. But, you know, I certainly do understand the wishes of a contender here to want to see the process go through and all the votes counted and certified, especially when it's this close. I mean, otherwise, we're essentially saying those that haven't been counted yet really don't matter. So there's a pretty good argument for that. But I think also the big winner here too are the labor unions who really surrounded and came to the rescue of the Quinn campaign. I was not impressed with the Quinn campaign early on. It did not seem to be very organized and together and to get out the vote in Chicago the way they did. Obviously, there were a lot of volunteers, a lot of people out there working very hard to get out that vote. And so I think certainly the unions played a big role, and I think that they're a big winner in the state with the gubernatorial race being this close, the Democrats retaining control of the legislature. It bodes well for the unions and their agenda.
Yeah. If Brady was to emerge the winner, how would he govern?
Well, I mean, it would take a really coordinated effort. It would really depend on the minority leaders in the House and the Senate being able to maintain discipline within their caucuses. If Bill Brady is elected and he becomes governor, there's going to be an intense testing of political wills. Governor Edgar could certainly tell you all about that with Speaker Madigan. That was a very difficult thing for him. It would be extraordinarily difficult for Bill Brady. I would suggest that they would probably pass a budget with the general tax increase. And if the governor is Bill Brady, I would expect he would probably veto it. And then that's when the battle is really, really joined. But that depends on the House and the Senate Republicans maintaining discipline within their ranks and a subgroup of Republicans not breaking off and forming a veto-proof bipartisan structured roll call for a budget with the general tax increase.
Well, and going into the election, Republican leadership has definitely tightened down their ranks, but it would just depend on whether that would hold or not. Looking at, like, pension borrowing, for example, passed fairly easily last year, and it was not able to make it through the Senate this year. Republicans who voted for it in the House were punished and stripped of leadership roles. So it just depends on whether they could maintain that kind of control after the election.
Yeah. And if Quinn emerges the winner, what do you expect to happen in terms of tax policy and spending cuts?
Well, you're going to see the partisan divide here is going to be much narrower. You'll see it's going to be 70. Currently it's 70 Democrats in the House. That'll be reduced probably by six. It'll probably be 64. 60 is a majority. Likewise, in the Senate, a reduction from a veto-proof majority of 37 down to probably 34, I think it would be, by the last count I saw. So they maintain a majority. 30 would be a majority there. So you got to remember, in this go-round, many of the legislators, Republicans and Democrats, heard the call of the Tea Party and definitely campaigned on no new taxes and fiscal austerity. And, you know, I have a feeling that the electorate has spoken, at least has offered some sort of a rebuke here to previous policies, and I think that's been noticed. And I think it's going to be very difficult to structure a bipartisan roll call for a tax increase in this political atmosphere, even if it's Governor Quinn.
Mm. Well, and part of the issue, even among Democrats who want to see a tax increase, is which tax increase. The Senate passed kind of their ideal tax increase that would reform school funding as well, but it was a lot higher, and Quinn has come out with this 1 percentage point for education, which he has said he will veto anything that isn't that plan, although I would be surprised to see him veto a tax increase if it did make it through the General Assembly. But a lot of Democrats, if they're going to put their vote on it, they want it to go far enough and do what they want it to do.
Ted McClellan, did the Tea Party resonate with folks in Chicago and in the collar counties?
Definitely not in Chicago, and I don't think they made an effort in Chicago. And I thought it was interesting that we had the first election of the year, and this was in February before the Tea Party really got off the ground. And throughout the year, Mark Kirk and the Tea Party really they wanted nothing to do with each other. And I think that the fact that he kind of pushed the Tea Party aside really helped him statewide. It looks like Joe Walsh is going to win a congressional seat in the 8th district, but I would imagine that has more to do with the Republican wave, and I don't know how long, even in that district, he can hang on as conservative as he is.
And there were some anti-Kirk Tea Party rumblings early on in the race, and Kirk definitely didn't seem to want to ally himself with that, but he's also moved a little bit further to the right, which I think has helped him out statewide as well.
Rick Winkle, the Illinois GOP scored some victories in the U.S. House. How significant are those victories for the Republicans?
Well, the congressional delegation, the shift, the pickup of four seats was, from a Republican vantage point, I mean, it's breathed, a fresh new life into the party. I mean, it's made Republicans once again a contender and picking up a couple of statewide seats, offices as well. But that has been a significant development in a state where pretty much Republicans were a dying breed. I mean, a party that was in decay and had no future. So this certainly is, and we'll see how long it would last. I mean, I understand the point with the in the Bean race, I mean, with Walsh. But what's really very interesting is the 17th to see that which was gerrymandered in a tortured way. I mean, a very amazing way to be a Democrat district and for this wave to be so significant to take the Democrat down and replace with the Republican It shows the strength of the wave. What I find really interesting, though, is that the wave seemed to affect, there's a national wave, and it seemed to affect Illinois only in the congressional part and maybe a couple statewide offices. But the Speaker Madigan and President Cullerton in the state Senate were able to erect enough protection, a firewall, as they were calling it, in the House, to keep out this wave and to come away with impunity to a large degree and maintain their hold on power and their majority. But this is a big, significant shift in the congressional delegation that has long-term implications.
You mentioned a gerrymandered district. One of the big wins for the Democrats in the state, if Quinn is elected governor, is that the Democrats will draw the map.
Oh, no question.
Yeah.
No question. That's going to be entwined throughout all these budget negotiations. Redistricting, reapportionment is very, very important. Republicans are probably despairing in large part for that reason today if they think that they're going to lose the gubernatorial race. But I would also, you know, I'd caution there because watching the Democrats in complete control for the last several years, I don't see a lot of cooperation and comity among themselves. I mean, to think that they're going to be able to divide up the state and do it in a way that's agreeable that so it can pass both chambers and be signed by the governor in the middle of a budget crisis where you're trying to put together a structured bipartisan roll call with a general tax increase is going to be very, very challenging.
Absolutely. I mean, when it comes to the remap, there's party loyalty, but then there's loyalty to yourself and wanting to hang on to that district that you're in that you know you can count on to elect you in the future.
Yeah. Ted McClelland, your thoughts on the upcoming redraw of the map?
Well, I, you know, I'm not really a Springfield reporter, but someone's going to have to go, and I imagine it's going to be one of the new Republican congressmen if the Democrats are drawing the map. I mean, they're going to have, four to choose from. So, you know, maybe this is how they get rid of Joe Walsh, the most conservative of all the Republicans.
Let me ask you this, Ted. How might a new mayor affect what happens in Springfield down the line?
How might a new mayor affect? Well, I guess it depends on who the new mayor is. I think that whoever the new mayor is not going to be as powerful as Mayor Daley is, which means that Mike Madigan is going to be even more powerful. I mean, right now, Mayor Daley and Mike Madigan are the two most powerful Democrats in the state. And I think the Madigans are now going to become the first family of Illinois politics. I mean, now there's talk that Lisa Madigan may run for mayor now that her path to the governorship may be blocked. I mean, some people may have reservations about putting that much power in one family, although obviously, certainly, if she's mayor, the city and the state legislature are going to be working in total harmony.
Mm. Jamie Dunn, what are you hearing?
I've definitely heard that Lisa may be interested in running for mayor. There's a lot of speculation that Mike Madigan may retire in the near future to clear a path for his daughter's political career, but, I mean, that's not something we're seeing an indication of in this race or anytime soon. He's definitely going to want to get his party through redistricting.
This is Focus. This morning we're talking about the decisions voters made on Election Day yesterday with the help of three guests. With me in the studio, Rick Winkle. He is with the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. He also served 12 years in the Illinois legislature. On the phone with us, Jamie Dunn. She was named State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Issues in 2009. She writes features for the magazine, and she maintains its blog. Also with us on the phone, Ted McClelland, former staff writer for the Chicago Reader. His latest book is Young Mr. Obama, Chicago and the Making of a Black President. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this morning with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, or toll-free, 800-222-9455. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. So if the speaker were to retire, who would be the next leader of the Illinois Democrats in the Illinois House?
Well, I was, as I heard that, I mean, I was trying to think who that would be. And that's a really difficult question. I don't see a clear candidate. I think Jamie's observation that reapportionment has to be in place first, I think, is right on the mark. I don't think the speaker would retire anytime soon in any event, but it's possible. It's possible if you know, the speculation, you know, comes to be true that Lisa Madigan wants to be mayor. You know, it's going to be interesting in the next several months. I would observe that if it is Governor Quinn and he's reelected, he has not shown himself to be a very strong leader. And that's what I meant earlier on when I said there's going to be a very intense testing of political wills that are going to be we're going to see this throughout the next several months here through the spring session to demonstrate who is actually in charge, who is predominant. Is it the speaker, which I think most people assume that that may well be the case. That becomes almost conventional in our wisdom, but that's going to have to be established. And I think there's going to be some struggle there even among the Democrats, even if it is Governor Quinn. And what's going to be interesting, when you don't have the steady hand of Mayor Daley kind of keeping things somewhat in order as best he can for the good of Chicago, of course, and greater Chicago area. But, you know, his steady hand is going to be missing for several weeks here. And, I mean, not that he's gone, but he's not running again. And I got to tell you, as somebody who has retired from public life, that does make a difference.
Well, and you have to keep in mind, any political office that opens up in Illinois, there's always speculation that Lisa Madigan is going to run for it. And, I mean, there's no strong indication that she's going to leave the job that she has now. She enjoys being attorney general. She has a lot of political capital. She could easily wait out a difficult time in Illinois in a job that she enjoys and run for something a few years later. She's got plenty of time.
Ted McClelland, how would the entrance of Lisa Madigan shake up the mayor's race in Chicago?
Oh, I think it would be huge. I mean, really, we now only have one candidate here who has really any broad stature, and that's Rahm Emanuel. And I just don't think people in Chicago really want to elect Rahm Emanuel. I went to the Obama rally on Saturday, and his petitioners were out there, and I heard people literally say, "Hell no," when they were asked to sign his petitions. I mean, there seems to be an attitude here that Emanuel's going to win whether anybody likes it or not, and there's just a real hunger for a stop Emanuel candidate, and I think Lisa Madigan would be embraced as that candidate. I mean, they come from the same part of town. They have the same, you know, geographic base, so I think she'd take a lot of votes from him in that way. So I think she'd be a popular candidate.
Why don't people like Rahm Emanuel?
Well, they think he's they don't think he's a real Chicagoan. He's lived here for 3 of the last 20 years, and in those 3 years, he somehow managed to make $18 million, which I think a lot of people wonder how he managed to make that much money that fast. They think he's a bully. They think he'll be another heavy-handed mayor like Mayor Daley is, and I think people really want a change in style from Daley. They want a stronger city council and a less autocratic mayor, and they're afraid that Emanuel is just going to be a continuation of that.
Mm. Well, I would agree that Chicagoans would welcome just feeling like they have a choice.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
They're definitely looking for that.
Yeah. How are you keeping track of who's in, who's not in the race for mayor? I mean, Rahm Emanuel's at the top of everyone's mind, but there's so many.
I've got to think that Reverend Meeks is a contender, as well as Carol Moseley Braun, and I think probably Miguel Devalle are names that I've heard, that people who I know that would be taken seriously.
Gary Chico is in the race.
Right.
He's getting a lot of good press.
He's the former school chief, and Devalle is city clerk.
Right.
And Carol Braun, Carol Moseley Braun, a former U.S. senator who had Barack Obama's seat before Barack Obama had it.
Right. But, you know, one after another, candidates just seem to be disappearing. And it just says something about Emanuel's image that people suspect that somehow they're finding a horse's head in their beds. You know, it was Tom Dart, and now Bob Fioretti was going to run. Turns out he has cancer, so he's out of the race. You know, people are even talking about how, you know, Emanuel pushed Mayor Daley himself out of the race on the Charlie Rose show. So he's seen as, you know, clearing out all the competition.
Yeah. Now, some of the people who have said, you know, thanks, no thanks, I'm not in this race, could they change their minds? I'm thinking of, you know, someone like Luis Gutierrez or Mike Quigley.
They don't have much time. I mean, the filing deadline is November 22nd. So, I mean, that's 19 days to gather 25,000 signatures.
This is Focus. Listeners, you can join us this morning with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455, the email address will-talk@illinois.edu. How are people feeling about Barack Obama in the city of Chicago these days?
Well, I think that Obama really deserves some credit for, especially for Pat Quinn. I was at the rally on Saturday, and Pat Quinn was up there and introduced Obama. And, of course, you know, Obama asked the whole – he asked the city to have my back. And the reports were that turnout was up in Southside precincts. I mean, and the day of the election and before the election, Obama went on a lot of the black radio stations, WVON, WGCI, and the exit polls showed that the black vote was going 91-5 for Quinn and 94-3 for Janulius. So I think he brought out a lot of voters who came out for him 2 years ago, and you know, might not have come out without that personal appeal. And you know, I think he helped drag Quinn across the finish line and made the Senate race closer than it would have been.
Mm. Absolutely, and I think if Quinn does pull this out, we're going to be picking it apart for a while because it really wasn't the expected outcome. Like was said earlier, it's a bit of a surprise that the race that we're still speculating over is the governor's race. A lot of people were expecting the Senate race to be a little bit closer, and Brady was pulling pretty well near the end of the governor's race. So it really looks like the ground game and possibly Obama were a big factor for Quinn in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And that's possible. I mean, that's certainly a factor. Of course, I know after having been in several close campaigns myself, not quite the scale, of course, but close nonetheless, we always try to figure out what it was that, you know, pulled us through and what was a factor. You know, I mentioned this before, and it's not that I think a big winner here and a big factor were the labor unions. They hit the ground running. They definitely wanted to protect the legislature, and I think they wanted to make sure that Bill Brady did not get elected. And I think that what's interesting to me about that, they also seem at the same time to have not paid much attention to the federal races. I think they picked their battle. They said, look, you know, the state house is what we want. That's where we want to put our capital. That's where we want to put our ground troops. That's where the effort's going to be focused. And redistricting, particularly for the state legislature. You know, and I think they pretty much ignored the federal races. And so you see this wave effect for the Republicans in the federal races, U.S. Senate and the four congressional races, that the seats that they picked up. But the wall was erected with the help of the labor unions to keep that wave from affecting the state legislature, the shift of power there, and may have protected Pat Quinn.
Absolutely. It seems like on the state level, the Democrats were able to kind of form a cocoon away from these national trends. And, I mean, they took some hits, but it wasn't nearly as bad as a lot of people were speculating it might be in the legislature. There was talk that they might lose the House, and that definitely did not materialize.
What do you think shaped up as the key issues in the gubernatorial race?
Oh, I think the economy. I mean, I think jobs. I think that's what people were most interested in. And I think it resonated. I think people are angry about the direction. They don't like the kind of pernicious sort of job, you know, the high unemployment rate that we just can't seem to shake. And we've seen a great deal of money spent trying to stimulate the economy, but is it really fair to directly say, you know, somebody's responsible for the economy or hasn't gotten it back on track? Probably not. I mean, in all fairness, it's probably. But nonetheless, when you have the responsibility and you have the power and you are in control, you also get the blame. And people right now are looking at whoever. If the Republicans were in control, they'd be thrown out. And so that's, to me, what's so remarkable is that the Democrats are able to hang on to the state legislature. I think that to me is major, and the fact that they were able to turn around the gubernatorial race is quite remarkable in this economic environment, especially given all the terrible news the last several months, a couple of years here especially, of fiscal mismanagement. That seems to be the indictment that the state is fiscally mismanaged. I think that that's become pretty much the public perception and the opinion, and I think that drove voters.
Yeah. Ted McClelland, it seems to me that here downstate, social issues were on the back burner. What was the story in Chicago?
Oh, it was not like that at all in Chicago. I mean, Bill Brady did not do a good job of making himself an acceptable alternative to people who did not think Pat Quinn was a strong manager. I mean, just his anti-gay attitudes, obviously that did not play well in Chicago. His anti-abortion attitudes did not play well in Chicago. The fact that, I mean, I guess this isn't a social issue, but the fact that he talked about lowering the minimum wage, you know, and do you remember the Pat Quinn dog ad?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I mean, that actually played well here because, you know, there are a lot of single people who's in Chicago whose dogs are their family. And to them, that was a social issue.
On all the social issues, not the dog issue, but the other social issues you mentioned, I think some credit then, you know, it seemed like a stunt at the time, but Senator Rickey Hendon certainly made a big splash in Chicago by his very direct frontal attack on Senator Brady, his colleague. And I think it had an impact.
And he only said everything that Quinn had been saying in politer language throughout the entire election. I mean, that's how Quinn had been trying to portray Brady. And Hendon just put it into blunt words.
Let's take a couple of calls now from listeners. First, we're going to go to Urbana, a listener in Urbana waiting for us on line one. Hi.
Hi. I wonder if your guests could educate some of us naive people about behaviorally, what does it mean to be a strong governor? What does a governor, you know, what do they have to do to be considered strong? And that, I ask, in reference to the rumor I've always heard that bills do not get brought up in the Senate and the House because the leaders don't want them brought up, and that's why they seldom get passed. And those are my questions, and I'll hang up and listen offline.
Okay, thanks.
Sure. Yeah, that's absolutely the case, especially in the House. Madigan has just a very tight grip on what even gets called, what even gets considered. There's something called the Rules Committee, and a lot of bills go there to die, and we never hear from them again. As far as what's considered a strong governor, one of the things, you know, Quinn has been criticized for is not being a strong leader, and so I guess I can use some of the things that have happened since he's been in office as an example for that. I think part of it is an ability to compromise while still being able to stick by your guns. Quinn had some trouble with that. He flip-flopped a lot. It was hard to predict what he was going to do. He was often very reactionary to what the legislature did instead of seeming as though he was the one leading the conversation. So that's a really important factor. Is there anything anyone else would like to add on that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you're on the right track there. I totally agree. But the Illinois Constitution gives the governor very broad powers, especially with the veto power. I mean, you know, he can totally veto. He can mandatorily veto. He can reduce line items. He can mandatorily veto line. The president of the United States doesn't have that kind of veto power, but the state governor, the governor of the state of Illinois, does have that power. And plus, the governor initiates the budget, and the caller is correct. I mean, it cannot run roughshod over the legislative process. Obviously, the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate have a lot to say about that. They can run the calendar, they appoint the committees, et cetera, and have a great deal of influence. But at the end of the day, it takes an agreement between both chambers and the governor on a budget. And, you know, Pat Quinn has not shown an ability to look over the horizon, over the edge of the horizon, and really see it clearly and stake out objectives and goals and stick to them. He can't stick to them. You're right. He reacts. He's too impetuous in his running of the administration, and that impetuosity, that lack of vision, has made him an easy target to manipulation by stronger leaders in the legislature, and that's what's happened. We've seen a dysfunction of state government due to a lack of a strong governor. That doesn't mean that the governor has to get along with the speaker and the president and do what they want. Rather, be a co-equal partner in this and stick to objectives.
Well, in fairness to Quinn, the budgeting process has been very odd the last two times around. Normally, the legislature, you know, works out the budget with governor, and it's a lot more specific of a process. The last two budgets have just been they've approved lump sum spending and basically handed it over to Quinn and said, you know, you decide where to cut.
Right, and my point exactly. And what should the governor do? A strong governor, in my opinion, should veto it.
And he's allowed that to happen. And I think
he has allowed it to happen. That's the problem.
Has been, I think, to not appear like Blagojevich, to not appear to be forcing the legislature into special session. But I would agree. I mean, that's the governor's job, and he's definitely failed to lead when it comes to the budgeting. He's allowed the legislature to just kind of toss the hot potato in his lap and let him deal with it, which gives him a lot of power. But it also means that he's going to take all the political hits for cuts that people don't like.
Let's take another call. A listener in Paxton on line 4. Good morning.
Yeah, hi, Celeste. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I had just a quick comment that I'll offer up to the guests, and then I had actually a civic lesson question. Maybe they could educate me. Anyway, I heard a story yesterday on NPR about these special interest groups and a huge amount of money that was involved in these elections. And the comment was made that, you know, these are kind of nameless PACs and organizations. Nobody really knows where they're coming from, but they have an enormous amount of money. And they said now that these groups might be turning their interest towards passage or killing of legislation. In other words, it's going to change the atmosphere, the landscape, the political landscape for quite a large, long time based upon the Supreme Court decision. And I just was wondering if your guests had any comment. And then I was not privy to the results for the election, so I apologize. Am I right to assume that State Senator Dan Rutherford was elected treasurer?
That's correct.
Yes.
That is correct. So my civic question is, once he takes office as treasurer, is his seat abandoned or is somebody selected? And I was just wondering, did you think that Shane Cutra, who's the state rep, for Vermillion County would take that seat, or how does that process work? And I'll listen off air. Thanks.
Okay, thanks for the call.
The county chairs for the Republican Party will gather in caucus, and on a weighted vote, they will appoint a replacement.
And I haven't heard a lot of speculation yet on who that will be. Those are often surprises. Sometimes there's a candidate that everyone thinks it's going to be, and then often it ends up being someone else, so that's kind of a wait and see.
And the issue about money poured into campaigns, that's a huge topic. And, you know, you wonder, why hasn't there been more attention paid, more reaction to the Citizens United decision? And for Jamie Dunn, we saw so much money poured into races for the General Assembly. So you want to...
Well, yeah, I mean, Citizens United, big case. I mean, obviously, it changes the landscape of campaign finance reform. It pretty much... if it hasn't put a nail in the coffin, maybe Senator Feingold's defeat last night did. You know, John McCain's become pretty silent on the issue. And so, you know, I don't think there's much of a future, frankly, for that style of regulated speech to affect campaign reform. I mean, that's the argument against it, and that's where the Supreme Court has gone with it. But what's interesting to me, too, is some of the implications we saw. One of these groups come in, or several groups come in, and try to affect to defeat a retention of Supreme Court Justice Justice Kilbride in the third appellate court district in the north central part of Illinois, and hundreds of thousands of dollars were spent on ads to attempt to thwart his retention, and he was retained. You know, I think there's a point, though, I think, where negative ads, you know, do work. That's why they're used. But there's also a point where you can go beyond and you can cross that line, and it can actually you end up alienating or getting a pushback from the electorate. So I think we sometimes we sometimes don't give the voters enough credit for the ability to sort through the messages, regardless of how many and how much and what the message is. You know, they do a pretty good job of sorting through. And in this case, I think that's a case where, you know, there's an attempt to use a barrage of negative campaigns, and it didn't work.
Ted McClellan, what's your sense about how voters voted in Chicago? Were they casting positive votes, or did they go to their polling places to vote against folks?
I think, you know, all throughout the state, I think there was a lot of negative voting. I mean, both of these, in the big elections for governor and senator, I mean, there was a lot of dissatisfaction with both candidates. I mean, in the polls, you'd see polls where neither of them could get above 40%, and you know, there was talk that, you know, this is, you know, we wish we had better candidates. We wish, you know, there was someone else to vote for. But, you know, I think that, you know, Janulius was just regarded as too inexperienced and corrupt, and Brady was regarded as too socially conservative. And, I mean, I think that Brady's election, just as Glenn Pichard's election showed in 1998, showed how hard it is for a social conservative to win statewide in Illinois.
Well, and there was some surprise early on that Brady was polling as well as he was, as socially conservative as he is.
Mm-hmm.
And he definitely made an effort to deflect those issues and say that, you know, this isn't really what people are concerned with. It's the economy. I don't have a lot of ability to change these social issues anyway, which may not be entirely true. But
right. But then he showed up at the Tea Party rally in the States.
And I, like you said, I don't believe that worked in Chicago. It may have worked some downstate where some people really are more concerned with the economy, possibly, or putting some of those things on the back burner. It's definitely been a trend in the Tea Party to sort of say, you know, those aren't the issues that we're talking about right now. But for people who really care about the social issues, you just can't say those issues aren't important this time around.
Right.
Rick Winkle, what are your thoughts about how Mark Kirk was able to win the Senate seat?
Well, Mark Kirk, you know, he's from a swing district in the North Shore, north of Chicago, that could trend Democrat. He's a Republican. It could be quite liberal. So he's played the moderate. You know, in some ways, I suppose you could say it was, you know, his experience is a microcosm of the state. The state of Illinois tends to be that way. I find this discussion about the social conservatives can't be elected. This one came pretty darn close. If he hasn't been elected, it's going to be within a few votes. And so, you know, apparently it's split in this state. So I don't think we can be dismissive toward a set of principles and that obviously people take pretty seriously enough to vote for a gubernatorial candidate who's known as a social conservative. But I also believe that part of what Bill Brady campaigned on was correct, that you know, he would not make social issues the first top priority of his administration. Rather, it was the economic and the fiscal management issues. And I do think that certainly resonated downstate, but I think it also resonated apparently not enough, but we'll see in the final count. But also to a large extent in the collar counties. And what's interesting, though, is and maybe this kind of undercuts my own point, is that Kirk, who was less socially conservative, did better. So, okay, I think that probably in Illinois that probably is an advantage. But I don't think we could be completely dismissive to social conservatives.
Well, I would agree. As I said, just the fact that Brady did as well as he did is an indicator that tide might be turning a little in Illinois.
I thought it was interesting that the Republicans captured the offices of comptroller and treasurer, speaking of fiscal management. Judy Bar Topinka, of course, had solid name recognition. But Dan Rutherford?
Well, that's right. I mean, he's got business experience, business mm-hmm. background. I mean, that's he's vice president in a major company. So I think that, you know, I don't know if there's a – obviously people don't have the analysis and, you know, to the same extent like a political scientist would. But I think intuitively we know that, you know, it's better to have more than one party in control. In mm-hmm. fact, maybe it's better to have, you know, our preconceived notions of Republicans that they tend to be better business managers. Let's put them in charge of the FISC. let's put them in charge of the Treasury. Let's have them keep the books at the comptroller's office and try to provide a little check and balance in our state government.
Well, in the Judy Bartzpinka and Rutherford definitely linked their campaigns together. They are talking about trying to combine the office. So I think that helped him a lot, too, as far as being linked to her name recognition and people seeing them as a team that would work together.
How did that play out in Chicago, Ted?
Well, I think that, you know, Rutherford, obviously he has more political experience, and he was running against, you know, Giannulli as his deputy. And I think some of his unpopularity dragged her down.
Hmm. How do you think, let's ask this question of Ted McClellan, since you've written this book about young Mr. Obama and how Chicago made Obama. What are your insights about the president in terms of how he will deal now with this new Congress?
Well, yeah, I just got an email just a few minutes ago saying he's going to be scheduling a conference call with Organizing for America members at 4:30 Eastern time this afternoon. So I think he's going into fighting mode, which I think is something people want to see from him. He now has a foil. He has an enemy in Washington, so he has somebody he can rally his base against, and I think that's going to be very good for him as far as his, you know, when he runs for re-election. I mean, he needs his own Newt Gingrich. I mean, Newt Gingrich really helped Bill Clinton become a better president and get reelected. So now that, and also, you know, one thing I saw in him in 2000 when he lost that race to Bobby Rush, I mean, he needed to be humbled then, and it really helped him find out what kind of politician he was. I mean, he found out he was not the kind of politician who was supposed to represent a single ethnic group. He was he found out he was a multi-ethnic politician. And I thought at the time, even then, he would have been better off as a Senate candidate than a congressional candidate. So I think it's going to help him find out what kind of president he is, too.
Well, yes, and I would agree having Boehner as a nemesis makes for a much better narrative than mm-hmm. not being able to get Blue Dog Democrats to sign off on the health care bill.
Well, the other thing, too, is just as one side can learn lessons, so does the other. Boehner is no Newt Gingrich. And so, you know, we'll see how they react. And it's a whole different atmosphere now with the more fiscally conservative element that now has been injected within the Congress and the Blue Dog Democrats having gone down in defeat. You know, it sounds to me like a recipe for not much happening in the next 2 years.
By the way, coming up at noon Central Time, straight up, we will join National Public Radio for the president's press conference. He will be holding a post-election press conference coming up at noon Central Time, and we will bring you, our listeners, that coverage live from NPR. Let's take another call. This is a listener in Champaign on line one. Good morning.
Good morning. I always enjoy your show when I have the opportunity to listen. And just wanted to make two comments, see what the guest thought about it. One, there was an earlier discussion on leadership, and even though I don't agree with Pat Quinn, he that's his major thing he needs to work on. Brady was seen as a leader, Quinn was not, but we all have to remember, leadership starts in Washington, and I think that's why the Democratic folks did not do well across the country. We have no leadership, number one, at the top. He's been missing in action on major international and national disasters and things like that. The other thing is the state vote, I viewed it as I wasn't voting against the particular, not so much against the Democrats or other parties. I was voting against the city and the county of Chicago and Cook. There is a huge, huge disgust with the amount of funding and that the state legislature controlled by Chicago, Madigan and his folks. And we really feel that Chicago ought to leave the state. I mean, we would be perfectly happy from Cook County down if you would secede and leave us.
And I'm gonna jump in here because
we got
the drift loud and clear. So
well, as a downstater, I'd like to say I would like to hang on to Cook County.
as a Cook County, I would like to say I would like to hang on to the rest of Illinois. And I wonder what some of these counties would do.
Yeah.
Where would they get their prisoners from? Chicago was the economic engine of the state. Most of the money that comes into Illinois comes through Chicago. So, I used to live in Decatur, and I heard the same sentiment. But, and I'm sorry that, this election was kind of one of the framing issues in the election was the downstate Chicago divide, and I think that's unfortunate. I mean, really, downstate and Chicago don't have that much in common. Chicagoans don't really visit downstate, but we're in the same state, so we all got to work together.
Hey, Ted, tell us about Obama and when he was running for, I think it was the Senate, I think. I haven't read your book. I sort of took a real fast run at it, and before we talk again about young Mr. Obama, I'll read it thoroughly.
Okay.
But he made an effort to get downstate, didn't he?
He
reached out to Paul Simon.
Yeah, he had, his legislative assistant, Dan Shulman, he could see early on that Obama had statewide ambitions, and he said, you've got to get to know southern Illinois. I mean, in Obama, he was a thoroughly urbanized character, and so he went down to deep southern Illinois. There was a family, the Skates family, he went to visited their farm, and they said he'd never really been on a farm before, but they showed him around. And he did experience some culture shock. He would see signs that said things like guns and swords for sale, and that kind of freaked him out as an urbanite. But he made more of an effort, I think, to get to know downstate than a lot of Chicago politicians do, which was admirable. And of course, there was the concern about whether some of these downstate counties would support an African American candidate. But I think. He did well enough when he ran for Senate there.
And I've got to wrap it up now, but I do want a last question for Rick Winkle. So what lies ahead for the Tea Party? Where does it go from here?
Well, that's a great question. I don't know the answer to it, but because I don't quite understand. It's certainly not organized along traditional ways of a party. I mean, there's no system. There's no doctrine. There's no central organizing group, so it's really scattered, and it's kind of a product of social networking, which is through the internet and technology. I think they communicate, and so it's really a very interesting populist sort of political organism that has grown. It's turned into a movement, and I think is going to be around for a while. So we'll see. The danger, I think, to the Tea Party is that they would be co-opted into one or the other party and become really just a subset or a part of it. If that happens, then they lose their impact, I think. But the challenge for the Republicans is that they have so many new candidates to identify with this Tea Party movement. How can they effectively govern and avoid the mistakes of Newt Gingrich in 1994 and see government shutdowns with this element within the party? How can we accommodate those pure sort of fiscal conservative drives with the need to govern generally? So it's going to be interesting.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Rick Winkle, thank you. Jamie Dunn, thank you.
Thank you.
And Ted McClellan, thank you.
Thank you.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of foods from around the world, including cheeses, olives, spices, hot sauces, olive oils, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309.
Let's take a look now at commodity prices. In Kansas City, December wheat is trading at 7.45 and a quarter, down 3 1/4. March, 7.60 and a half, down 3 3/4. December wheat in Chicago, 6.91, down 3 1/4. March, 7.30 and 3/4, down 3 1/4. December corn, 5.79 and a half, up 3 3/4. March, 5.93, up 3 3/4. May, 5.99 and a half, up 3 3/4. July, 6.02 and 3/4, up 4. November soybeans, 12.27, up 3 1/4. January, 12.36 and a half, up 2 1/2. March, 12.44, up 3 1/2. May, 12.43 and 3/4, up 2 1/2. July, 12.50, up 4. December meal, 3.38, that's up 30. December oil, 49.73, up 10. December live cattle, 98.37 and a half, that is up 12 and a half. February, 101.77 and a half, down 7 and a half. November feeder cattle, 111.20, down 35. January, 111.82 and a half, down 22 and a half. December lean hogs, 67.25, that is up 105. Outside markets, December crude, 84.55, that's up 65. The U.S. dollar, 76.84, up 12. The CRB index, 304.58, down 40.